afternoon, everyone. I would like to call the Health Care Committee to order. It is February 4th, 2016, and I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1514.
Senator Devlin's here.
Oh, Senator Devlin here? Where is he?
He's right at the back door.
Back door. Okay. Scratch that. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1585.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1585 increases the fees to obtain nursing licenses by endorsement, directs the monies to the Oregon Nursing Advancement Fund. It also permits the Department of Human Services to make payments to certain long-term care facilities that purchase, to adopt rules relating to the purchase of the long-term care bed capacity. This has an emergency clause effective on passage. This also has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And this is a bill that is fixing a couple of existing policies.
Great. Senator Devlin, is it Jana Bitton and Jim Carlson?
Seems like we should swear these people in. Looks like a rough crowd.
No. Oh, because I don't have
the vice chair.
Well,
I'm just saying.
I will.
He said he will. I'm just kidding.
No, please don't.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. I'm Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. Thank you for this opportunity to speak on SB 1585. This bill was submitted in order to make a handful of necessary budget fixes. SB 1585 will make changes to previous legislation so that it works properly for those that it impacts. Changes include an expansion of who a self-imposed fee impacts, a change in the fee payment schedule, and a change in approval process and deadline for buying and closing nursing facilities. I will let the representatives from the Oregon Healthcare Association and the Oregon Center for Nursing discuss the details of the bill, but please accept my strong support that SB 1585 moves to the Ways and Means Committee for further fiscal examination. If I can explain just very briefly why the bill comes forward beyond my prepared remarks, is that in the last particular session, the nurses came forward and actually imposed a fee on themselves. You will hear the good things that fee actually does, but actually in reality, we could not change in the bill that we had when those funds were transmitted from the Board of Nursing to the Center for Excellence. So they were stuck with the existing law that said the transfer of those funds that they actually voluntarily agreed to impose on themselves could only be transferred on a yearly basis and not on a quarterly basis, which kind of says if you're going to volunteer to pay a fee, that you would like it actually to start doing the things you really want it to do. But we couldn't actually correct that in a program change bill because it was not instrumental in terms of actually implementing the budget. So we decided we'd come back in this session and correct it. Also, a small group of individuals were left out of that, and that is basically the nurses that buy. I always thought that the word, and actually even some of the early documents that I had, said endorsement, but it's actually endorsement. Were excluded from this fee, a very small portion of the nurses. So to be fair to all the nurses, I think the feeling is that it should be imposed broadly. And I don't think you'll see anybody in this audience that's going to object to that. And then in terms of the issue with the Oregon Healthcare Association, I think those of you on this committee in particular are aware of the long history of this issue and trying to find greater efficiencies in the provision of long-term healthcare needs. And this is one of those basic provisions that makes sense for the people that are operating the facilities, and actually makes sense for the state in terms of being efficient in how these services are delivered. So I will leave it at that for these two parties, and I actually have to get to another committee.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
But I'd be happy to answer any questions.
thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Devlin, is this a finished product? The reason I ask is it's going down to Ways and Means and the relating clauses relating to state finance. I'm just wondering if it's an opportunity for other things or just pretty much it.
I believe at this particular point it's pretty much it.
Okay.
The original relating clause for it was could have been relating to health care.
Which would you prefer, Senator?
But I will tell you what I've told everyone about the bill is that I would never intend to put anything into it that is controversial. Never. If somebody discovers something in the next week or 10 days that needs a minor tweak, we'll put it in there. But I actually used one of my bills because I was a little bit frustrated last time because there were a few items that we couldn't actually correct that were logical to correct. Right. So I just wanted to have a vehicle to be able to do that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Any more?
That's it.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Montes Anderson and Vice Chair Cruz and the members of the committee. My name is Jana Bitten. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Nursing, and I'm here today to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 1585, which was put together to clarify some of the language of the previous legislation from I'm sorry?
You can scoot back a little bit.
Excuse me.
No, sorry. You're just a little too close.
Okay, thank you. Excuse me. There we go. Excuse me. To clarify some of the language from Senate Bill 72. As you remember from last session, Senate Bill 72 imposed a $9 surcharge onto nursing license fees in order to create the Oregon Nursing Advancement Fund, which would be used to support the work of the Oregon Center for Nursing around research of the nursing workforce and also convening different groups together to work on specific issues. As Senator Devlin said, in the last 6 months or in the last year since this legislation has passed, we've been able to put out some new findings around our nurse faculty and the shortage that we anticipate that we're going to be experiencing because of that. Also, some more information about and also convening some groups together to take a look at that and some other reports that we've been able to put online. However, that work has all been done without the benefit of the license surcharge that has been collected because we only receive one payment per year, and so according to the legislation that was passed. So this new legislation in Senate Bill 1585 is to clarify that, to allow the State Board of Nursing to be able to disperse funds more on a quarterly basis as opposed to an annual one. The other piece of this bill is also about including those nurses that are licensed by endorsement. It's around about 2,700 nurses that are licensed in Oregon per year by endorsement, and that was a wording that was omitted from the original language. And so this bill is put forward as a way to correct those two main issues. And that is about it. And thank you very much for this opportunity to testify. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Jim?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Carlson, President of the Oregon Healthcare Association. The provisions in the bill relating to the nursing facility capacity reduction initiative merely make a date change. It changes the effective date to qualify for the capacity reduction incentives from December 31st, 2015 out to June 30, 2016. We encountered parties trying to execute some of these capacity reduction agreements. They're pretty complicated agreements to get done. Oftentimes you've got lenders involved, including lenders like HUD and others. And so getting all the parties to understand the moving pieces of this and to get them all aligned and to get these deals executed in a timely fashion proved to be challenging. There were two projects that they were looking to qualify by the end of the year, but they were not able to get basically all the legal work done and all the paperwork completed. And so we believe that by extending this an additional 6 months, we think there's potential for another two, possibly three of these capacity reduction initiatives to be completed. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
No, thank you for visiting us in our offices. Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1585 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1585. And before we start, I do want to, I'm an RN subject to the renewal fees and I am being, this does affect me. All right.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1585 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and request that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 1585 to the floor. floor with a due past recommendation and that it be sent on down to Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Although my spouse is part of a larger class and not subject to conflict requirements, I did want to put on the record that she is a nurse practitioner and would be affected by this fee.
Okay. No further discussion. We're in work session. The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries, and it is on its way to Ways and Means, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1585, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1514. Sandy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1514 we had during our legislative day hearing. This is a concept, as you recall, which will permit drug outlet participation in the charitable prescription drug program to repackage certain donated prescription drugs for distribution. Specifies that the distribution of the donated prescription drug is not distribution by a wholesaler or a wholesale drug outlet, declares an emergency effective on passage. You do have a dash one before you that they will be speaking to, and we do have a minimal fiscal impact on the dash one and a no revenue on the dash one. And
okay, let's have Adam Kircher and Marcus Watt.
Good job.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Adam Kircher. I'm co-founder and director of Serum, a nonprofit based in California that is helping this program get started in Oregon. Serum's aim is to ensure that no person skips taking the medication that they need due to cost. Unfortunately, one in four people in the U.S. can't afford the prescription drugs that they're supposed to be taking, and so skip their medications. Serum does this by helping long-term care pharmacies donate their medications to charitable pharmacies to ensure that the uninsured and underinsured Oregonians get the medications that they need. These medications are all unopened, unexpired, and not controlled. We operate in four states, have helped over $5 million in medication get to vulnerable populations, including homeless people. And we think we have a wonderful opportunity to get this program up and running in Oregon. And so are using this bill to help access more charitable pharmacies. The reason for the bill is that the bubble packs of medicine that come from the long-term care facility can't always be utilized by a charitable pharmacy. So there's a lot of charitable pharmacies that are eligible to participate in the program, but they just don't have the specialized equipment or the specialized storage that they need to actually use the medicine. So this would allow the charitable pharmacies that can actually repackage that medicine to send it to the charitable pharmacies who aren't able to currently utilize that medicine. We've very much enjoyed working with the Board of Pharmacy and are supportive of all the amendments.
Great.
Chair Morris Anderson, committee members, my name is Marcus Watt. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. While the board is technically neutral on this bill, we fully support the goal of the bill, which is to help improve access to needed medications by the indigent and low-income people of the state. We would like to thank Senator Gelsers and her staff, as well as the proponents of the bill, for allowing us to help work on the Dash 1 amendments in the bill. By this collaboration, we've been able to craft the amendment that allows us to increase the access while still maintaining a safe supply chain of the medication. So the Board of Pharmacy staff is very much comfortable with the rules as written, the statute and the amendment as written, and we feel this is a good bill.
Great. Any discussion? Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1514 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1514.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 15. I move the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 1514.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 14. Is there any discussion? 1514. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition?
Okay, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1514 as amended by the dash one amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 1514 to as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? The clerk will call the roll.
Senator
aye.
Senator Keel?
Aye.
Senator Steiner-Hewitt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Monis-Anderson?
Aye. Motion carries. Senator Gelser will carry the bill, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1514.
I'm waiting for Senator Bates.
And we are now waiting for Senator Bates. So let us stand at ease. Okay, we will resume our the Senate Committee on Healthcare. We are on Senate Bill 1531, and Senator Bates, it's all yours.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, Alan Bates, State Senator. I have two really important and complex and controversial bills up. You've got one of them in your committee. The other one's in natural resources. So I assume this is suction dredge mining? Not quite, huh?
That was once referred to us in the beginning.
This bill is the result of, as you are most aware, of the controversy and difficulty we've had in CCO land and with OHA in the last 18 months. Some of this boiled up during the last session. I made a personal promise to certain members of the legislature, including especially Representative McLean, as he voted on a certain bill for me, based on the fact that I would go look at this and try to bring some clarity to the issues involved between OHA, CMS, and the CCOs. I want you to know that right now there are things behind this bill that we're not probably going to discuss today, but I want to go through the bill with you real quickly, give you an idea of what it does, and give you a little bit of a background on it, too.
Now, are we as a question, are you going to go through the base bill or amendments?
We're going to go through what I consider the dash threes.
Okay.
Okay. There will be a dash four coming to you by next Tuesday. That puts what we call a sunset on the evergreen proposal, but we'll talk about that when we get to it, I hope. So behind this is there's a tremendous amount of competition between the CCOs about market shares. That's a very difficult situation. I'm not going to go into that today. There's a lot of moving factors in it. Some people support the bill because of it, and some people oppose the bill because of it, and it's a very difficult situation. The other issue here is the Oregon Health Authority states it's going to be able to do the things in the bill without the bill being done. I would say the things we've asked them to do in this bill they have not done. They've had time to do it. As an example, something as simple as getting people enrolled in Medicaid in this state, the bill asks them to do it within 45 days. 37 states right now do it in 24 hours. They're working on this. They'll probably improve it, but that kind of stuff has been going on for years. We really want to stop it. As far as how the bill is going to move, we believe that by the time we get the last amendment into it, and you've had a chance to look at it, there probably is going to be a physical on it. It'll probably go down to Ways and Means, not for major changes, thank you. If they are any, I'll swing back to you. But that's probably where we'll end up. Some of the drivers to this are the things you've heard about clawbacks. Some of the drivers are the loss or potential loss of a local community to run its CCO, and the risk of CCOs being bought up by outside the state people, bought up by large CCOs buying smaller CCOs. When this program was first set up, it was designed to be community-driven, coordinated care, doing things outside of what we call encounter data. Encounter data is how many times you saw the doctor, how many pharmacies you went to, and prescriptions you got, and how often you went to the hospital. That's the old way of doing things. This program was designed to transform health care for the Medicaid population and deal not only with encounter issues, but also issues of poverty, homelessness, mental health, drug and alcohol, and those issues. Some areas are much further along, such as, quite frankly, the Bend area. Some others are areas are moving in different directions, which are good, supporting public health, working with hubs. Those things are starting to happen. But if we continue on the process we've been in the last year, we're going to lose those. I've had several conversations with CMS. I should tell you, probably there's been 30 or 40 meetings. I've gone to Baker City and across the state talking to people over the last 6-7 months and talked to CMS directly. Quite frankly, CMS is divided on the same issues. The actuarial section of CMS wants encounter data to be the driver for it, set rates off that. The policy people want more of transformational issues going on. So we've got a partnership with CMS that we have to handle very carefully, very cautiously, but we want to drive it in the direction that's away from actuarial soundness, whatever that really is, and move more towards transformation, but keeping actuarial soundness in the picture too. So with that background, I want to walk through the bill very quickly with you here. You'll be hearing more from both sides of the questions as we go through this. Section 1 just contains definitions. It requires OHA to establish a benefit package once a year. It permits change of the benefit package only if required by federal law. Subsection 3 of that specifies the elements that OHA must take into account in determining global budgets, which include, as I've said before, cost expenditures and reinvestments of savings into providing health services, community benefit initiatives, and flexible service and other means of addressing the social determinants of health. In other words, if you've saved money in your system, you get to reinvest that money, and we want you to reinvest that money in your system. We don't want that Medicaid money, which is state and federal money, going out of the state. We don't want it shifted around the state. We want it to stay in your community to make your community healthier. Talks about the financial range between related parties. Some of these CCOs have very large subcontractors. We want to know about those subcontractors, where the money's going, and who they are. Section 5 requires OHA
okay,
to
hold
make...
It, hold.
I'm sorry.
Okay, so as you know, I have had CCOs, and I'm sure the rest of the committee has come in to meeting with this on the various pieces. Unfortunately, their responses were to the dash ones, and I'm not quite sure how different the dash ones are from the dash threes because I haven't really had time to do it. But in section one, first of all, I want to ask you, I remember you saying at those intensive long meetings that you've had and that I've been able to listen to on phone that you want, and thank you for all the work that you've been doing on this, but you want total consensus from all CCOs. I mean, that's what I heard from you.
I want a consensus to me is not everybody agrees, but that they agree enough that those are willing to stand down, those agree, and you don't have opposition directly to it.
Okay, well, I just need you to know that Section 1, and I believe it's... 2 and 6 are the only two items that were in total agreement on the dash ones, and I think they're the same. And so I get concerned when a majority or more of the CCOs aren't in agreement. So
I don't think you'll find that a majority of them are. You'll find that we still need to work with HealthShare and its component parts. And the CCO in Central Oregon on some of these issues, but really it's one organization, and actually two organizations that are still concerned about this.
Okay.
Okay, out of the 16. But what section were you exactly concerned about?
4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay. And maybe you haven't received this letter.
I received the letter. We're working on it already.
Yeah,
and some
good.
Of the things they're concerned about, we met with them earlier. A couple of those pieces are out. The major issue left is the evergreen part of this bill.
Okay, because there are 8, and I really want to make sure that they're...
Most of them are in one organization.
Columbia, Eastern, HealthShare, Jackson Care, Pacific Source.
Is that in
Columbia, Gorge, Pacific Source, and Oregon?
Yeah. Columbia Pacific CCO, I believe, is part of HealthShare. HealthShare is HealthShare. Jackson Care Connect is part of HealthShare. Pacific Source is working with Legacy. and EOCCCO is owned by MOTA. Okay, so most of them are in one organization.
So you don't know. Okay. Well, I'll have that clarified because I thought they were a part of the 16, their individual.
They are listed as part of the 16, but they're really under one umbrella. Okay. All right. And should be listened to. They have legitimate concerns. So can I continue?
Yes, please. Okay.
Section 4 is talking about sufficiently detailed financial reporting requirements to allow for accurate comparison of CCOs. One of the things we talked about was comparing apples to oranges and issues between looking at CCOs and what they're doing, trying to get them all in the same kind of an accounting so we can understand them better. Section 5 requires the OHA to make readily available to the public for each CCO financial data, healthcare utilization data, related party arrangements. Again, this is about transparency so we can see what's going on and understand better what's happening. 6 requires OHA to notify a CCO by October 1st of each year of the specific requirements and outcomes that the CCO must meet in the following year in order to qualify for incentive payments. This was one issue that was very, very brightly outlined by all the CCOs. They want clarity in what they're supposed to be doing. They want it early enough so they can respond to it. Section 2, this requires OHA to apply for the necessary waivers or amendments to the state plan in order to implement Section 1, the one we just talked about, by January 1st, 2017. We have to work with our CMS partners, and we need to get that waiver proposal to them. We need to be open about what we're asking for in that proposal.
And you'll be working within the CCOs?
The way it's worked in the past, apparently, is OHA basically does the waiver themselves. We want them to be more open about it. We want to know what the conversation with CMS is like. We want CCOs to be aware of it. We want the legislature to be aware of what's happening. We want some openness here between OHA and CMS. For the first time this last year, I've had to have direct conversation with CMS so I could have a better understanding of the issues going on. And I've been on the phone with them 3 or 4 times, and I'll be meeting with the director by phone, I think, next week or the week after to go over these same issues again.
Okay. Okay, and I'm not involved in that. You know more about the CMS relationship with the state. I wouldn't count on that. I just want to make sure that this isn't going to complicate the communications that we have with CMS.
I don't believe it will. It's been actually pretty helpful, I think, for both parties. I just want a clear understanding and an opportunity to let them understand what transformation and social determinants are and how we're looking at it here in Oregon. I should also say that everything I've heard from CMS is that they're very excited about what we're doing in Oregon, don't want us to change, think we're leading the nation in really changing how healthcare is delivered, what we mean by getting a population healthy. We're probably the only state doing this. They don't want us to lose the traction we've got already. Subsection 3, may I go on?
Yeah, Section 3, it seems to be fine with everybody.
Okay. This is complex stuff, and we've spent a lot of time on it, and I know it's making your eyes glazed over, but I hope it doesn't do that too badly. I want to give you an overview of it, and you'll have a lot more testimony on this before we're through here. Section 3 requires OHA to maintain a log of all open record requests related to the establishment of global budgets. The log must be made available to the public, and this is when this open records request is, it's actual written stuff going back and forth. We struck language that said if you have a conversation with somebody, you've got to report that. That is impossible to do, and we struck that from the bill. Section 2 of Section 3 requires OHA to post to its website all written communication with CMS concerning CCOs. Again, it's written, not any conversation going back and forth. The website OHA has stated to us is very clunky and difficult to use. They're working hard to make that something we all can use, CCOs, general public, anybody who wants to check in.
Madam Chair, can I just ask a quick clarification? Senator Bates, just a really quick clarification. Believe me, I'm all about openness and transparency, but 24 hours, I mean, what if something comes in at 4:45 on Friday afternoon and nobody has a chance to really process it? Is that going to have to be up? Or I'm not trying to nitpick here, but I want to make sure that we're not setting somebody up to fail.
Good, Good point. I'll check into that.
Thank you.
We're really thinking a working day when we said 24 hours, but we should probably think about weekends and holidays.
Yeah, I think we have to be clearer about that because usually it's a business, you know, one business day or whatever, yeah. If you really want it to be that quick.
And what about the funding for, I mean, in order to get the website up and running, there's...
Like I said, there may be a fiscal. Okay, we're giving them 18 months to get the... Well, they've got one up and running. It just doesn't function well. We're giving them 18 months to work on this. Okay. Section 4 amends current law regarding the amendment of the CCO contracts. It has new requirements that contractors must comply with state and federal law and incorporate all the statutory requirements for CCO contracts. That's pretty boilerplate.
Wait, can I just... Yeah. I'm sorry. Are there issues now, Senator, about contracts containing terms that have not been consistent with state or federal law?
I would tell you that we've had attorneys suggest that's the case. I am not expert enough to make that statement. Okay. But I can get that answer for you.
I'd appreciate a little clarity because, you know, don't get me wrong, I agree with it, but I don't want to try to solve a problem that doesn't exist.
I'm with you. I will. Madam Chair and Senator Steiner Haywood, I will find the answer for you.
Thank you.
Okay. OHA must notify a CCO in writing if the CCO is not meeting its outcome and quality measures or other criteria specified by OHA rules. Key here is to get it in writing in a way it's understandable so people are clear about what's going on. There's been a complaint that it wasn't clear enough, it wasn't specific enough, and they didn't get enough notice. OHA must provide a CCO with a reasonable time to fix any deficiency before terminating a contract, refusing to renew a contract, or refusing to enter in a new five-year contract. The five-year contracts are coming up, I believe, in 18. So this sets the stage for some of this. Section 5 sets procedural requirements for OHA in establishing global budgets. Number 6 is really important. It prohibits clawbacks. So if you set a global budget, but you cannot claw back that money unless the federal government specifically requires you to claw that back. As you may well know, that was a bit of a controversy this last year. And it's something that we really wanted to be clear on, that if it's not required by the feds, and we want it stated by the feds, they want it back, not that somebody said they did. We want it clear. 7, this is one that is extremely controversial. This is the evergreen provision. The evergreen provision requires OHA to continue to contract with CCO at the expiration of the five-year term unless the CCO has substantially failed, I understand it's a legal term, to comply with contract or to make meaningful or not to make meaningful progress toward meeting the outcome and quality measures. What this is trying to get to is leveling the field between OHA and the CCOs, and this is not an easy thing to do. We struck many parts of this because we're talking about contract law here. We didn't want to go into contract law. We don't think we should. But we don't want CCOs negotiating contract situation where they essentially have a gun at their head that says, if you don't accept this contract, we're terminating you and giving your lives to the next guy. Some people like that kind of a bidding process to drive price down. We're not trying to do that. We're trying to make people healthier and communities healthier. So if you meet what you're supposed to be doing here and you can't agree on the rate setting, there's a process you go through legally to have that settled. And that's what we're trying to get to. This will probably still be debated over the next week or two before we come to a consensus if we can. It's a very difficult issue and probably the most difficult one in this. Section 8 ensures that CCOs have a remedy in circuit court for contractual disputes. That goes back to 7, really. So you can pick the county you want to be in if it's either Marion or the county you're actually working in. Section 5 amends current law to say that if OHA allows a Medicaid recipient to opt out of a CCO because the recipient wants to see a provider who is not credentialed by a CCO, and this is an important statement here. Some CCOs have credentialed people you wouldn't think as mainline, but they do. Some chiropractors, naturopaths, some others, and they credential them and will work with those people, but they won't credential everybody in that group. So if an individual on Medicaid wants to see a specific provider that's not credentialed, they can do so, but the CCO does not want to be liable for that care. By that I mean, most of these people don't cover themselves with liability insurance, or it's very minimal. And if the CCO says, yeah, you're fine, we'll do it with you, it opens them up to liability if something doesn't go well. and there's lots of different groups out there that could happen with. So this is a protection for the CCOs. This has not been controversial. It's a way of allowing people who have made a decision to be outside of CCO to come back in of the CCO if they wish to, but the CCO is not liable for whatever happened prior to that time.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Senator Bates, I appreciate the intent of this, and I think overall it's a reasonable idea. My only concern is that I understand that right now, under current malpractice climate, it's impossible for a certified nurse, midwife, or a physician to get coverage for home births. That doesn't mean that's not going to change in going forward. So would it be reasonable, if you're going to include this language, to change it to, because direct entry midwives are licensed now. We have that process, right?
Not credentialed, yes.
Not credentialed, but licensed. So could we say licensed healthcare provider or something like that, so that it allows for some flexibility in the hope that eventually we're going to get to a climate where there can be home births by other people?
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner-Harewood, this is a liability issue, I believe, when I explained to me. And it actually, there was a discussion about direct entry midwives with it. And the CCOs have agreed that if they want to come back in after the delivery or whatever's happened, they're okay with that, but they don't want to be liable for anything that happened with a delivery or some other treatment outside.
No, I understand that.
That's what this is designed for.
Okay. Well, we'll play with it a little bit.
And lastly, Section 6 amends current law to require OHA to process application renewals of Medicaid in 45 days as required by law. OHA says they're going to fix this. As I said earlier, a lot of states are doing it in 24 hours. Deloitte is on board for this. The One system is coming up. It will be rolled out over the next 6 months to a year. Hopefully that issue will be resolved, but this has been a major problem for CCOs. They don't know who they are inside the CCO for a long time. They get lists that aren't correct. There's all kinds of problems, and we put it in statute just to say, you got to really get this fixed, folks. We can't let this go on any longer. It's been 3-4 years, and we just haven't made progress. So that's a very fast overview of it. It is, unfortunately, I wish I could bring you something that was absolutely complete. It is not. By Tuesday, you'll have a -4 amendment, which we believe will put a sunset on the Evergreen proposal so that it'll be looked at again in the future. And there may be new language around the Evergreen proposal. We may not get to complete consensus. I'll warn you of that. What we do have a consensus on right now amongst all the CCOs, we asked them this today, do you want us to continue the conversation? Yes, they did, and they want it sent to Ways and Means to continue that conversation. That is up to you, Madam Chair, and the committee to make that decision. If the fiscal is large enough on it, it would go there probably at any event, but I would not. I would much prefer to have your blessing than take it down there, and I know how you feel about making policy at that level. And I'm afraid that sometimes we're forced to do it, and I actually share your concerns.
When do you think the -4s are going to be done?
They should be out. We believe they'll be out Monday. They're pretty simple.
So then we meet Tuesday. The CCOs will need to have a chance. We may be bumping this to Thursday before we make the final decision.
We'll be meeting with the CCOs again on Monday afternoon. And I don't know what our timelines are for moving things through at a 4-week session. If it's,
I have to have everything out by next Thursday.
Okay. I would appreciate moving it Tuesday so we have more time to work it out in Ways and Means. But I understand it's your, you know, it's at your discretion.
Senator Cruz.
I would like to have this as complete as we can get it, and sometimes the pressure helps get us to the point we need to get to. So,
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, I hear you.
Okay, and I would also suggest something of this significance. Thursday might not necessarily be the deadline because of where it's going next.
Yes.
So,
but can I just mention a few things? Because we are getting a lot. Everybody in this room, all CSO, have a horrendous amount of respect for you, and they do not want to go sideways with you. So we need to be doing some of the heavy lifting, and I don't want you have to get mad at us and not them, because they obviously aren't going to tell you what they'll tell you what they like, but they won't tell you what they don't like. But anyway, just some of the things that I've been hearing regarding the definitions, and even definition of flexible spending. So I'm not sure what the opposition to some of these definitions are, but I wish that those would come forth with some language for you. There is many who say this is too broad, dealing with complex issues and the waiver conversations. So they are worried about the impact. And let's see. We also just want to make sure that the ramifications, especially on OHA, is doable. And I have no idea really what their status is with the websites and trying to get that up and running. And you know, I think we're heading in the right direction. We knew when we were going through transformation that there was going to be some glitches, and I think we're making some really good efforts. And it'll be very interesting to see what the CCOs say when they come up. I know some are very happy with the way it is, and then some are not. But they are. Want to keep the conversations going for sure.
I appreciate your comments, and I think you're absolutely right.
Okay.
All right. All right. We got a whole list of people here.
Am I dismissed, Madam Chair?
You can be dismissed.
I have to go look at suction dredge mining next.
Okay. All right.
One of the things I admire about Senator Bates, but wonder about his sanity, is the kinds of issues he's willing to take on.
I know.
That's a low IQ problem, okay?
Oh, I see. Okay.
I would suggest you could question the sanity of all of us, but that's a whole other matter.
Yeah, well, there's that point, too.
Because it's very interesting. When you look at this sheet, Senator Bates, I mean, we have people that are neutral and people who are for. So you know where we are on that. Okay. All right, so let us start with Ashlyn Strong, Marion Blankenship, and Jeremiah Rigsby for the first three up here. And I guess Henry O'Keefe, if you want them, you all up at the same time. That's one panel.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ashlyn Strong, excuse me, and I represent HealthShare of Oregon. HealthShare is a private nonprofit coordinated care organization that contracts with the state to serve approximately 240,000 Oregon Health Plan members in Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. We were founded and continue to be governed by 11 familiar healthcare organizations, counties, and social service agencies, none of which are the CCOs on this panel with me. Approximately 2 months ago, Senator Bates informed us that he was interested in crafting legislation that would support the sustainability of the coordinated care model, and we were excited about that. He asked us to meet with our CCO colleagues from across the state, as we often do, to come to consensus on issues of concern to be addressed in the short session. We did that, and those consensus issues were shared with the committee last month during the legislative days. Senate Bill 1531 addresses many of those issues, but it also makes some complex changes to CCO budgets, contracting, and legal dispute processes. We have not had sufficient time to vet these concepts with experts in actuarial science, law, or federal Medicaid policy, and we feel like that kind of vetting would be necessary before we can feel comfortable supporting this legislation. There are a number of concepts that we can support, which we listed in our testimony, that were included in the Dash 1 amendment. I believe those sections are still included in the Dash 3 amendment, although we just got a copy of that and have not had time to review it thoroughly at this point. But we did want to thank Senator Bates for bringing us all together and beginning these more complex conversations that we've had over the last 2 weeks. We're grateful for the opportunity and look forward to further conversations and opportunities to collaborate with all of you and with each other.
Thank you.
All right.
Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marion Blankenship. I am the Vice President of Government and Community Relations for Pacific Source. We are an independent, not-for-profit organization. We serve commercial, Medicare, and Medicaid members, and we are the contracted entity. We hold the contract with the state for two of the 16 CCOs. We are not affiliated with HealthShare. The two CCOs that we are a part of are in Central Oregon and also the Columbia Gorge. Thanks for allowing us some time to comment. Mostly, I think I want to echo Ashlyn's comments. We have participated in all of the work group conversations. They have been very rigorous and robust and pretty fast-paced. And we certainly thank Senator Bates for his continued championship around this issue, and quite frankly, to all of you. Just really acknowledging that I think everybody here has a very significant stake in making sure that we're able to really sustain the coordinated care model. Ashlyn noted that most of the CCOs were able to coalesce around a set of what we thought were fairly straightforward issues that might be appropriate to address in the 2016 session, and those are outlined for you. There are two or three fairly challenging components of the bill that we feel like we don't have consensus on at this point. We're happy to stay at the table, willing to stay at the table and continue to see if we can get there. But I think that we, too, really need the opportunity to sort of scrub through these issues and do the kind of diligent review that is really required. I think the one piece that I will share that I know I've gotten, you know, fairly consistent feedback is just we do have some concern. We are somewhat leery about having this bill play out at the very same time that the state plan amendment waiver conversations are going on. And that is certainly something that's fueling our concern. So thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and Senators, members of the committee. My name is Jeremiah Rigsby. I'm the Senior Manager for Federal and State Regulatory Affairs at CARE Oregon. And a point of clarification of what that means, CARE Oregon is a part of HealthShare. We are one of, I believe, four risk-accepting entities at HealthShare. Five.
16.
Risk accepting, overall, in the different, yes, for physical health and mental health and oral health. But CARE Oregon also owns two CCOs that are in different parts of the state. And I bring that up because it's, A, important to know that what happens at HealthShare does not have an impact on Columbia Pacific CCO and Jackson Care Connect. And also, as I've said before, the issues that affect HealthShare in the metro area are very different than the issues that affect Columbia Pacific CCO in the northwest portion of the state. And those issues are very different than the issues that affect Jackson Care Connect down in the southern part of the state. And when we come to the table to talk about a bill such as this, we bring to the table some of the issues that we're dealing with in rural parts of the state and also in the metro area. So having Columbia Pacific CCO sign on to this letter and having Jackson Care Connect sign on to this letter is representing, I think, a broad swath of CCOs with different issues. I do want to say thank you to Senator Bates for the work that has gone in to putting this bill together. There have been a number of hours and long conversations on these tough issues. And I think we are starting to make progress on a bill that we all agree with. I think this bill is coming with good intentions and from a good place. I think many of the CCOs have actually been encouraged by progress that OHA has made as well over the last year, both in setting rates properly and in the communications and lines of communication that have been developed between the agency and the CCOs. We look forward to continuing this conversation. There are things in this bill that are incredibly complicated that would make you lose sanity, as was mentioned earlier. And it's been hard to get to a consensus on some of those issues. We even disagree amongst the CCOs about which issues we disagree with. At the same time, it is important for us to have this conversation now. I think it's important for us to have this conversation together, Ways and Means, your committee, all of us together. I'm so curious for everybody else's voice, not just ours. And we look forward to continuing the conversation. But I do want to say we're very grateful to have been part of this process so far. And it's been a very collaborative process, and we hope to continue it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. My name is Henry O'Keefe. I'm Greater Oregon Behavioral Health's in-house attorney. I'm here representing the Eastern Oregon Coordinated Care Organization. EOCCO began as a joint venture between Moda Health and Greater Oregon Behavioral Health, and now has a much more diverse ownership structure, including a number of provider and hospital systems in the EOCCO service area. I just wanted to say that we have felt like this has been a great collaborative process so far and look forward to continuing to work towards a consensus.
And okay.
Thank you.
What I would like to know, when I'm looking at the dash threes, you don't agree with some of the definitions because I would like you to put on the record what in section 1.1 are the problems, and these are definitions: community benefit initiatives, eligibility category, flexible services, related parity, social determinants of health. I mean, have you in this committee or group work session worked on those definitions? You didn't list that as something that you support yet, and I'd like to know why.
Go for it, and I'll play sweeper.
Okay. Chairwoman Sanderson, members of the committee, we did discuss a number of these definitions during the work group meetings, and I think there isn't too much disagreement on most of the definitions. We, again, haven't had an opportunity to look through the dash threes, so I'm not sure if anything has changed since the dash ones. But we do have some concerns about the sort of the prescriptiveness of section 3, so section 1, subsection 3, and section 1, subsection 5. And I'm just speaking for HealthShare at this point. And we would just like more time to work on those with our colleagues, CCOs from across the state. We did offer a suggested amendment to what is now section 1, subsection 4, that we thought would address our concerns. But we did not have an opportunity to have a conversation with the other CCOs about that.
So I would like to just share from Pacific Sources' perspective, we had a chance to look at the language that was suggested by HealthShare around that particular section, and that was language that we also supported. I think that we had some early concerns around the definitions around community benefit investments and flexible services. That language has been adjusted somewhat. I'll just say for the record, at that point early on, our concern was that our governance structure model in both of our two CCOs is somewhat different than the rest of the CCOs, and every CCO obviously has, you know, its own twist. But we were just concerned that the language as it was originally written might somehow undermine the ability for us to actually have this joint management agreement with the two regional health councils that we work with. I think that the language is broader and more general, which I think probably gets to our concern. But it's something that we need to take a close look at in the dash three for sure.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay, then jumping to section two.
Section one,
subsection. You already addressed that. Okay, let's just jump to subsection two. The Oregon Health Authority shall submit to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services amendments to the state Medicaid plan. What's the problem here that you need, that you couldn't get to agreeing to?
Chairman Anderson, members of the committee. I think we just neglected to list that as a section
that
we're fine with.
Oh, good.
But it was also tied in with a lot of the things in section one that we had questions about the way it was written. So it would be dependent on those things being resolved.
Okay.
And for a point of clarification, as we were trying to sort of pull together a joint statement, we really wanted to just try to highlight the main components that we had agreement on at this point. So we didn't highlight line by line every piece. So sorry for any confusion.
Well, I guess, on section four, you didn't list. And it's hard for a committee to, when Senator Bates is working hard with all of you, for us as a committee that's supposed to make decisions on the policy, what it is in like section four that you do not like. I'm not worried about five. I'm not worried about six. So section four, and then the evergreen provision in section seven, and then the opt-out. Just give us a little bit more information.
Chairman Anderson and members of the committee, I can speak to the evergreen provision, and I can speak to echo Marion's thought on what we were presenting. I think speaking for Columbia Pacific CCO and for Care Oregon and for Jackson Care Connect, most of this bill we think we were pretty much neutral on. There were things in this bill that we did not like, and we've been working with Senator Bates to either remove those provisions from the bill or to soften those provisions up. And we've seen some changes from the cursory view we've given to the Dash 3. I think it's hard for us now to say line by line without having gone through the Dash 3 a little bit more thoroughly what has been changed and what has not been changed. One thing I think I could talk to you about at length at this point is the evergreen provision. And that provision right now, as we're kind of understanding it, and I think it's going to be amended and talked about on Monday, would allow recontracting almost for as long as a CCO, as far as we understand it, as long as a CCO doesn't substantially fail in meeting the terms of their contract, they're going to get a new contract. I think at a high level, when we develop CCOs and we have this idea of healthcare transformation, while we're very appreciative of the security that it would provide CCOs, we're kind of arguing against that security for the good of the system, because we don't think that you should be guaranteed work for providing the Oregon Health Plan indefinitely. I think one way that Senator Bates is looking to keep work from being guaranteed indefinitely is to have a sunset provision. I think my thought to that is we need to have some serious conversations about how long that sunset provision is. There is an argument to be made that we recontract, CCOs recontract with OHA every 5 years, and that five-year number is arbitrary. There's an argument to be made that that number is not arbitrary. You want to keep incentivizing CCOs to get better and better, and you reevaluate that every 5 years. And that conversation is not an easy one. Right, that's not a conversation. That's a short one. That's CCO system transformation, and we hope to have that conversation over the next few weeks. They have that conversation for the rest of the time. There are CCOs. That's just something that's always up for the debate. One thing we know for sure is that we don't think that CCOs should forever be guaranteed work.
I hate to ask you to give feedback on the Dash 3s when the Dash 4s are coming through. I mean, that's a lot of work. But I
got an email from Lori Freeman.
And Lori Freeman just emailed our administrator
saying the Dash 4s that are in the works will sunset one that won the provisions in 2026 but don't have any substantive effect on the bill. So I'm not quite sure. It sounds like it's just a sunset date.
So my initial thought on
yes,
Chairman Anderson and members of the committee, my initial thought on that is, does everyone agree that 10 years is that the CCO system as it exists right now should continue as it is for 10 years as long as people are mediocre or better?
Madam Chair. Question for clarification. In the metropolitan area, Portland metropolitan area, do patients have a choice of going to one CCO or the other, or are they assigned and cannot leave that CCO?
Senator Shields, members of the committee, in the metropolitan area, there are two CCOs, and every member has a choice when they sign up for the Oregon Health Plan. And then for the first 90 days, if they don't make a choice and they are assigned for the first 90 days, they can choose to switch, and then they can also choose to switch once every 12 months for no reason, or they can choose to switch at any point during the year for a reason, so for cause.
So at least in the metropolitan area, I don't think you would be rewarded with mediocre performance. You could always go to the competing CCO.
Yes, in theory, Chair Anderson, members of the committee, in theory, yes, the member can vote with their feet, right, like a marketplace. I think that I would like to have a longer discussion over what it means to be continually contracted with. Like, is it just, should it be substantially fails the contract, that mediocre or better level? Should it be 10 years? Should it be 7 years? Should it be 80% of the metrics that you hit or 90% of the metrics? Should it be about provider network adequacy? There's a lot of things that we can actually, that you're really talking about what you're expecting a CCO to do to help with healthcare delivery transformation. And I don't think you can do it in three lines. I think you really want to build in the vision of what we want CCOs to be for the next 10 years. And I think this is a start to that conversation. I just think it's a long conversation and we want to have it. So
thank you. Madam Chair, if I could just follow up. I understand your point. I think it's a valid one. I would just say that I think, at least in my experience in the metropolitan area, that it's critical that we have two CCOs so that a patient does have an option. If they're not getting the care that they need from one, they can go to the other. And so I'd feel comfortable with the evergreen provisions, at least in the metropolitan area. And if, you know, other areas have problems with it, maybe we cut them out of it. But I would feel very comfortable doing the evergreen provision in the Portland metropolitan area.
Senator Steiner here.
You know, Senator Shields, I think your point's well taken, but I guess my question would be, there's nothing that prohibits it. I mean, forgive me, because we started this 4 years ago, and I was kind of under the Niagara Falls in the year we did this. But there's nothing that prohibits a new CCO from organizing, right? So, I mean, if a CCO, I think your point's very well taken, and I completely agree with it. I guess my question would be, if it were clear that one of the two CCOs in the area was not meeting those standards, and we didn't have the evergreen provisions, and OHA chose not to renew a contract, would there be anything that would prohibit another group coming together and forming a CCO? I recognize that's not a trivial undertaking, but we have other CCOs that are functioning in multiple parts of the state and could expand into that area to provide overlapping coverage, right?
Chair Monis Anderson and Senator Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, yes. And there is a rulemaking process that has set up a service expansion process for situations that are similar to that. And there's, I think, legislation right now to also talk about service area expansion. If I think those are more for existing CCOs. But there's nothing that would keep a new CCO from forming and then working with OHA to contract for that area.
Okay. I just want to be clear about that, because I think Senator Shields' point is well taken. I just want to be sure that we're not saying that means we have to necessarily accept a mediocre CCO with an evergreen provision.
Other comments? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kevin Fills, Beth Ann Darby, Fawn Berry, and BJ Kavanaugh.
Did you say Kevin Fitz or Kevin Fields?
Fitz.
Fitz, good.
Oh, it's the L's were not crossed.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Why I said Fields.
Okay.
Fitz.
Okay. You guys go ahead. I'll go.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Fitz. I'm with the Oregon Mental Health Consumer Association. We are a collection of individuals across the state that use your public mental health system and also are involved in peer service provision and policy oversight and planning throughout your public funded system in Oregon. I wanted to say we certainly appreciate the work that Senator Bates is doing and his conscientiousness about that. We are currently neutral about this particular bill. But in relation to a relating clause, we wanted to submit a suggestion, two suggestions briefly, to put within the CCO contracts. And I think, do you have a copy of that in front of you? I gave it to Legislative Services.
It's on all lists.
It is? Okay. And let me just read it. I would like to submit two suggestions for inclusion into Oregon's coordinated care organization contracts into this bill. One is a housekeeping. Number one, to include the CMS Medicaid billable and recognized job title classification peer support specialist. Everywhere the job title classification, peer wellness specialist, and community health worker are referred to. It seems like a housekeeping and semantic issue, but Medicaid actually reimburses for the peer support specialist term, and all without throughout the CCO contract, it states peer wellness specialist, so there seems to be some confusion around that. And the second one, for peer workers within the system, since we've had the health transformation bill, it instituted a program certified within the state called peer support services, where individuals with lived experience, whether it's addictions or mental health issues, are actually providing services in criminal justice outreach, homeless outreach, psychiatric crisis services throughout your system, certified through the Oregon Health Authority's traditional health workers, called peer support services. Currently, there is no contract language that people should be offered an opportunity to receive peer support services if you are severe, if you have severe and persistent mental illness and are receiving services throughout your CCO system. So the second suggestion is to include in the CCO contract language a guaranteed service benefit of peer support services to be available and offered to all individuals living with severe and persistent mental illness who are receiving behavioral health services treatment in Oregon's system. Currently, throughout your system in Oregon, probably 2% of the people who provide public mental health services are identified as peer services workers. We come from a long tradition of peer service workers and peer service traditions, particularly from Alcoholics Anonymous, suggesting that one alcoholic helping another is significant and consequential when all other avenues fail. Through in the 1960s, 1970s, the idea of the wounded healer in the psychotherapeutic movement, and in the 1970s and 1980s through the apartheid movement, the phrase, nothing about us without us, you shouldn't make a law, you shouldn't make a decision about our health care unless we're at the table and involved. And one last plug for peer services. Peer services saves money. You're high utilizers of the hospital. It also provides a path out of the system to build natural supports so people are not particularly dependent on intensive Medicaid services for the rest of their life. So anyway, that's my comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we did talk about this, I remember, in the transformation process. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is BJ Kavanaugh. I serve as Executive Director of 1 in 4 Chronic Health. We are the Chronic Healthcare Collaborative for people in Oregon. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you before you today, and wanted to offer our comments in support of the bill with the -3 amendment. We believe that while the CCOs have been remarkable in the delivery of care for tens of thousands of Oregonians, we do require some increased transparency moving forward. The issue that came up earlier last year with regard to the purchase of Trillium by an out-of-state company left many people scratching their heads and wondering whether this was allowed and how we move forward. Our concern is that we have more transparency in this organization or in these organizations moving forward so that we're able to best determine as a people, as a community, where to put the resources necessary to benefit everybody. We also see this as a fantastic move forward with adding the social determinants of health, social indicators of health in this. We've talked for decades about prevention, but if this is the type of prevention, if we put our energy and our funds behind, we have the ability to impact healthcare for the next generation, the current generation, in a way that we can only imagine. I'll close by saying that we also see this as a vehicle for perhaps being able to do some outside-of-the-box thinking in delivering care that is proved to be expensive till now. For example, looking at some payment methods and some methods to be able to provide hepatitis C cures for the tens of thousands of Oregonians who need them. This has an impact not only on the life of the individual that we're curing, but also on the public health and the family of these individuals. Thank you for the opportunity. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Senator Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, Beth Ann Darby, External Relations Director for the Oregon Health Authority. I am just here to give my thanks to Senator Bates for allowing me to listen in on the stakeholder roundtable he held with the CCOs. This bill started out pretty organically. We appreciated that there were some proposals that we understood to be consensus, and we appreciated the opportunity to learn more about them. I think that's what has become increasingly clear to me over the last 2 weeks is just how very complicated seemingly simple ideas are. We have not had an opportunity to review the Dash 3 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments were quite different, I think, than what we were expecting. And we have a lot of questions and concerns about how the interplay works between the waiver, federal funds and federal matching funds specifically, as well as federal regulations. We look forward to doing further analysis on that as the bill continues to be fine-tuned. I think we hope, as far as definitions go, that as many policies and definitions that can be matched up against federal guidelines and the waiver, that we can do that as much as possible. Certainly, the federal government is the third party to our contracts with CCOs, and it's important that we make sure that we have alignment between the three to avoid confusion. Thank you.
Questions for this panel? Yes.
Thank you. I just wanted to let you know how much I appreciated your comments. I think one thing I like about this bill is that the kind of the quicker public records sunlight that is being put on OHA, I think, is good public policy, but it only makes sense to do the same thing for the CCOs. I mean, they're controlling billions of dollars. They shouldn't be meeting in open public meetings, and it's unfortunate that's not in this bill. It's something that I know all the CCOs hate, but it really needs to happen, and I don't know how we get there, frankly, and that's going to be somebody else's task as I'm hanging up my spurs. But I think a lot of the problems we're seeing in Douglas County could be dealt with if there was just a public process so we can understand how decisions are being made.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, thank you. Yes, as an Oregonian and as a taxpayer, I'm very proud of the fact that my tax dollars are going to help my friends and neighbors and the people in my community. I just would like there to be a little bit more accountability in how we do this. We know that treatment's expensive, but we also know that we cannot put a price on the life of the people that we are serving. So thank you, and Senator Shields, when you do hang up your spurs, we hope that you'll be working with us on this side of the table. Thank you.
Fine.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Fawn Berry, and I'm here today representing Mylan, Inc., and I have nothing to say about the actual CCO bill. I'm here in support of the Dash 2 amendments to the Senate bill. The Senate bill just so happens to be related to health care, and so these amendments fit nicely within the relating to clause. The committee might remember in 2013 you passed legislation that allowed for an entity to receive a prescription for epinephrine auto-injectors if that entity employed a trained individual. It was a bill that was very popular, and currently 47 states actually allow for schools to have entity prescribing of EpiPens. Oregon was the first state to actually allow other entities besides schools to have entity prescriptions or names prescriptions in the name of the entity if they hire a trained individual. Since that time, 19 other states have adopted similar laws. The problem that we have is that implementation of the training program through the Oregon Health Authority hasn't quite happened yet. And when we started to look at the rulemaking this summer, issues were brought up about the statute and about whether or not the statute allows for an entity to possess the epinephrine auto-injector. So they can receive the prescription, but they can't possess the actual epinephrine auto-injector. There were also some concerns about the language around training. There was a train-the-trainer provision which would have meant that somebody who had been trained to administer an epinephrine injector could then train someone else, and there was no stop in when that happened. And so we took out that provision in statute as well. When we were in the rulemaking, there were also discussions about registering with the Board of Pharmacy and potentially paying fees for that registration. And we're talking about entities that just have this one prescription for an epinephrine auto-injector. They're not stockpiling prescriptions or anything like that. So we didn't feel that that was appropriate. So this amendment would also specify that the Oregon Health Authority or the Oregon Board of Pharmacy couldn't require us to register or pay a fee for registration. So those are the details of the amendment, and we would appreciate your support. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, seeing none, thank you, Fawn. The final panel is Courtney Johnston, Bill Murray, and Phil, is it Greenhill?
Greenhill.
Chair Montes-Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Courtney Johnston, and I'm here today on behalf of the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon, representing eight organizations working with coordinated care organizations. I want to start by thanking Senator Bates for allowing all of us to participate in the formation of this legislation. As you probably know, bills in a short session don't always get the opportunity to be properly vetted by stakeholders, and I think what you've heard today is that this concepts in this bill have been worked on for several months, that there were 2-hour and 3-hour meetings on this legislation, that where Senator Bates pulled together representatives from the CCOs, from the Oregon Health Authority, from the governor's office, members of the House, and as you mentioned, Madam Chair, you joined us by phone for one such, I believe, 3-hour meeting. And that is to say that I appreciate, it was a 2-hour meeting, okay. Two meetings, I appreciate. Anyway, what I'm saying is I really do think that having an inclusionary process like this is the best way to develop policy, and we all had a great deal of opportunity to weigh in this process and to, you know, work with our in-house lawyers to kind of work together and find compromises in different areas. And I know that it's continued to go through several iterations and getting new amendments now, but it's gone through a lot already, and I appreciate being a part of it. I understand we won't always get to complete agreement, but I appreciate providing a broad-based input. We think there's some really good things in this bill that I think the senator laid out pretty clearly, especially providing legislative intent prior to the waiver discussions. I think that's very important. Before I kick it off to the experts here, though, today, I just wanted to note for the record that we don't believe that anything in this bill is inconsistent with the framework that was set up during transformation and the creation of the CCOs. Working through the discussions with Senator Bates, we believe this is codifying what is always was the legislative intent in the first place. And with that, I will let my colleagues here go.
Thank you, Courtney.
Thank you. Chair Montes-Anderson and Vice Chair Cruz and members of the committee, my name is Bill Murray. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Family Care, a CCO that serves over 125,000 members in Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas, and Marion counties. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to the committee today in support of Senate Bill 1531. 1531, as Courtney just stated, further strengthens the legislative foundation for the development of coordinated care organizations and healthcare innovation in Oregon. In pursuing the best interests of the more than now 1 million individuals who receive healthcare through the Oregon Health Plan, Senate Bill 1531 clarifies accountabilities, requires transparency, ensures fairness, provides stability, and demands that we continue to seek improvements. Now, that's a big list, and it's a short session, but you know these are all doable, and we owe it to the Oregonians that are covered by the Oregon Health Plan to continuously make improvements, and that's what Senate Bill 1531 does. Specifically, Senate Bill 1531 requires the OHP benefit package to be established in advance and remain in place without change for 12 months, allowing for continuity of care, making sure we can plan appropriately and deliver those benefits. It also requires that all costs and expenditures and investments made by a CCO, including costs or innovative initiatives undertaken to help address the social determinants of health, are considered in developing the global budget. to not exclude, to not include these or to exclude them from consideration dampens a CCO's incentive to innovate and collaborate with community partners in overarching long-term initiatives that improve health. The bill also requires OHA to consider and examine all related party transactions between a CCO and entities they do business with. This is to ensure that data is comparable across all CCOs and that the overall state funding of the OHP is appropriately established. CCOs now operate in a wide variety of business structures, all legal and necessitated by their individual unique needs. However, these structures resulted in CCOs transacting over $1.4 billion in expenditures with related entities for just 2015. These transactions need to be examined to ensure that the global budget of one CCO is not over or understated compared to the global budgets established for other CCOs. The bill also requires OHA to collect sufficient data in a manner that ensures uniform comparison of the data between CCOs and to make that data public. Data made public would be at an aggregated level and not disclose individual provider payment arrangements. OHA has not established data per reporting standards, and reporting instructions are minimal at best, resulting in a wide variability and inconsistency in the amounts reported among CCOs. Furthermore, OHA's publishing of these amounts infers that there is comparability and uniformity when it is known that there is not in the data that is published. The bill also appropriately provides that a contract with a CCO may be terminated if the CCO fails to meet outcome and quality standards or is otherwise in breach of the contract. So I think there's clear agreement and understanding that a poor performing CCO, maybe even a mediocre CCO, would not be allowed to continue in business. Conversely, the bill also seeks to prohibit OHA from terminating at will a CCO that is performing well and meeting its outcome and obligations under its contract. An at-will termination is inconsistent with the expectations of CCOs to invest now in innovation that will pay off later and to build relationships and partnerships with communities and work collaboratively in promoting improvements in population health over time. For similar reasons, Senate Bill 1531 provides that OHA shall offer a renewal contract to a CCO at the end of the current five-year term. The prior discussion talked about or seemed to infer that that contract wouldn't require or would not include increasing demands to improve care over the period of time over the next five-year period. As we've already seen in the current five-year period, metrics have changed, metrics have been replaced, the required outcome on those metrics have been increased. So the idea around a renewal contract is not just maintaining the status quo. That contract would include provisions that would continue to challenge us to deliver better care to the members we serve. Other provisions in the bill require timely disclosure or processing of information. All are needed, all are doable, all result in improvements to the system now, not later. On behalf of Family Care, I urge you to support Senate Bill 1531.
Thank you. My name is Phil Greenhill, so Senator Mons Anderson, thank you for allowing me to be here today, Vice Chair Cruz. Appreciate the opportunity. I'm the CEO for Western Oregon Advanced Health. We serve Coos and Curry County, the south coast of this. Senator Steiner-Haywood, I'm going to speak a little bit to some of our recruitment issues we've been looking at the last 2 years, give you a little brief update. I'm going to personally take this down to ground zero and talk to you a little bit about why Section 7 is so important and why it's a pivotal part of this bill. It is the bill, as far as I'm concerned. I don't understand some of my peers. This is 9 pages on dash 3. I just sat back there and read all 9 pages. I understand all 9 pages, and I talk pretty slow. So I apologize. I've also just spent 2 weeks in OHSU for a medical condition, and I can say that that is an absolutely the finest treatment I've ever experienced in my life. When you have an opportunity to be a patient in a magnet hospital and you see BSNs rise to the level of care that's delivered there. And I'm going to speak briefly to that about our rural health campus and what we're doing on the South Coast in regard to our association with OHSU and some of those developments. There's many, many things that have happened in the last few years when it has come to the CCOs, and we've watched them unveil in our communities and bring community thing efforts to bear. In our case, we have 9 partners in our community. We have a county government that owns 10% of our organization. We have a critical access hospital. We have Senator Shields' $6,000 on the table right now to allow a local television station to actually publicize our meetings and to take them public. And we're going to do that with our public district hospital, too. So we're following, you know, public design, and we're going to, you know, be able to sit at home on television and watch that board meeting if you're interested in doing so. And so those are some of the things. But I'm going to talk to you a little bit about a $70 investment to a $7 million investment and why Section 7 is so vitally important. Because as former Representative Tim Freeman said, this isn't transformation. This is evolution of health care. And evolution, as we all know, takes time. So on the $70 investment the other day, the benefits changed on vision. And we had a member that continually was going to the ER. And we get a call from one of our case managers. And she says, Phil, you know, the benefit doesn't allow this man to get glasses. And I said, well, what's the problem? Well, you can't read his prescriptions. Well, if he can't read his prescriptions, he doubles up on his hypertension drugs. He ends up in the ER. So we call our ophthalmology clinic, where Dr. Otto Miller serves on the board of directors for our CCO, and Dr. Gilbert serves on our IPA board, and we say, what can you do? And they call back, and they say, well, guess what? For $70, we'll do the exam, and we'll give the man a pair of glasses. For $70. So in flexible spending, we spend the $70, and the man can read his prescriptions, and he doesn't go to the ER, and he doesn't over-medicate, and he stays on his treatment plan. That's community health care at community work. Now we fast forward to our community action and a community program, our Earning Learning Hub, our community food bank, and we find the fact that the truck's broken down, and we can't deliver lunches to kids all the way from Coos Bay to Brookings. And it's an $80,000 truck, and they're $35,000 short on buying that refrigerated truck. So out of flexible spending and CCO budget, we step up and we spend that $35,000. And now that truck leaves every morning in Coos Bay, and it goes all the way to Brookings, and then delivers food and lunch for 8,000 kids. A kid can't go to school on a hungry belly, all right? So these are transformations. These are investments that go forward. Then you fast forward to the OHSU comes down and wants to build a rural healthcare campus on the South Bay with Klamath Falls. And we work in association across the street with Southwest Oregon Community College, with Dr. Carla McKelvey, who's become the associate dean, with Patty Scott, president of SWOC. And we come across the street. We buy 5 acres. As an IPA. And we look at the county, and the county's got about 50% of the money to replace a building that was built in 1940, which its own health department occupies, of which its own health department should condemn. That's how bad the building is. And we sit down and we think, well, there's 5 acres next to community action. What happens if we put public health there in a new building and mental health, and we put the CCO on that campus, and we put it next to community action, and we put it next to the food bank, and we put it across the street from the community college, and the community college then takes the 6 new treatment programs in the proposed new public health building that we've already broke ground on, and we build a student health clinic so the students can simply walk across the street to that facility. That's a $7 million investment. Am I going to spend our board's money? Am I going to spend money on that when I know I maybe only have a 2-year contract and I've met all the metrics? I served on the first appointment to the metrics committee, metrics measurements committee. I'm responsible for part of those. I was there. I served on the committee that looked at reimbursement and rearrangement of alternative payment methodologies for our critical access hospitals, where we've come up now and split those that can. We signed a contract last December with Southern Coos Community Hospital. We're in the process. We have Coquille Valley Hospital, who owns a percentage of our CCO, a critical access hospital, actually buying and being part of a CCO. We cannot make these investments that add up to millions of dollars without some guarantee that we're going to be in business longer than 2 years from now. That's why Section 7 is so important in this bill. It is the pivotal part of that this bill. It is the part. I am responsible for calling Senator Bates insane. If we do not have something that resembles an evergreen clause, this bill is worthless. Okay? Then we need to do that. And when it comes to recruitment, the sidebar, we have increased our PCP recruitment in the last year by 10%. We now have 6 new providers in town that are asking for members. Who would have thunk? We turn around and we look at a plastic surgeon from Legacy who moved his reconstructive practice to our town. He now comes back to Legacy once a week. He specializes, Dr. Vangelisi specializes in cranial issues with newborns and everything. What happened? The University of Pennsylvania has someone that's interested in rural health care, and they send us a resident ready to graduate to our community in reconstructive plastics. He meets Dr. Vangelisi. Now we have 2 plastic surgeons on the South Coast. Who would have thought? Who would have even dreamed that we could have a plastic surgeon anywhere in Southern Oregon practicing? It's happening because of CCOs, their transformation, their innovations, and their investments in the future. I cannot look at my boards and say in a fiduciary manner, put millions of dollars into this project when you might not be here 2 years from now. If we meet the quality metrics, we meet the standards, we deserve to have extension of contracts. That's only good business. We're not asking for guaranteed franchises. I'm not buying a McDonald's. We're investing in community. And I'm building public health centers. I'm not building basketball arenas. Okay? And I can tell you point blank right here today that our organization on the DCBS criteria is reserved 2 times greater than any commercial insurance product in this state. That's what we need to look at. We need to look at financial stability going forward, steadiness, and investments back in the community. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Very powerful. Senator Steinberg, did you want to say anything?
I guess I have a couple of things I want to say. First of all, thank you to all of you for all of your commitment to providing the best health care for everyone in Oregon, whether they're a CCO patient or not, because every investment that you make in your community and in facilities or whatever are investments is an investment that will help not just those who are CCO members, but everybody in your community. I don't disagree with you. I am old enough to remember going into practice in the mid-90s, in the quote-unquote glory days.
You could be my daughter.
Managed care. No, probably not. I'm older than you think I am. You know, the whole concept was that we'd be invested in upfront preventive services and early chronic disease management, that we would be better off, and ultimately it would save us money, and why wouldn't anybody want to do that? The problem was that it was the primary care providers who were on the hook for that, individuals, and the insurance companies didn't really care, all due respect to my colleagues in the insurance industry, and employers were switching insurance companies every year. So why would I, as a primary care physician, invest in a lot of preventive services if I thought that the next year that wasn't going to be my patient, right? The money was put the wrong place. So the point is we're doing that right now. We're starting to. We're getting better. We're putting the money in the right larger places. And your point is well taken, that if you don't know you're going to have a contract in 2 years, it's pretty darn tough to convince your board to invest millions of dollars. I don't disagree with that in the slightest. I still worry about the concept of quote-unquote mediocre care, and I don't know whether the right number is 80% or 90% or 95% or 87%, you know. That being said, I don't think you guys want 80% to meet 80%. I think you want to meet 100%, right? That's not what I'm hearing from any of the CCOs. So this is a struggle for all of us to figure out how to do it, how to protect you and the investments that your CCO is making in not just the CCO patients, but your entire community. But how do we not try to get overly ambitious and do too much at once? This is a pretty big bill, right? And I hear your point loud and clear about the evergreen provision. And frankly, I've not heard OHA saying that we want to go around cutting contracts willy-nilly either. So I want to, well, this is a, I freely admit, this is what I try hard not to do. This is a statement rather than a question. I'm just telling you clearly what my struggles are. And I know how your community has struggled with primary care and with psychiatry and with pretty much everything else, right? Because that's one of the reasons I worked so hard in the 13-15 budget to get $7 million into loan forgiveness and loan repayment programs, and I continue to work on that. And we've had those conversations, you and I, about that very issue. I guess that's about all. I'll stop rambling. But this is a tough problem. These are exactly the ways we think about it.
Remember, a great quote, a healthy populace is a country's greatest asset.
That would be true.
And it was said by Winston Churchill right after World War II. He knew if he couldn't put a healthy population back into the factories, he couldn't rebuild that.
Yeah.
And that is our greatest asset.
I agree.
Is a healthy population.
I completely agree. You know I do. That's why I'm sitting here.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, panel. Thank you. Anything else? I see that Dr. Bates, Senator Bates, is back, but he doesn't want. Just observing. Okay. Well, I would thank you. I certainly would like as many people to be on board, and if there are specific suggestions, please talk with Senator Bates if we need to come up with the dash fives. I think with that, are we all done? We are adjourned.